Psalm 74 is again another psalm that we reflect on in Jesus' company. I don't think we'd pray it, but you make up your mind on that. The psalm is not included in the lectionary, the readings for the Mass, but it is used in the prayer of the church, in the prayer during the day for Tuesday, week 3. The assumption behind the psalm is that God is ultimately responsible for whatever happens. And so for the destruction of the city and the sanctuary. The psalmist understands that God must be angry to allow this destruction. We've seen that a lot in the Psalms and all through the Old Testament. It doesn't seem to fit with God as revealed by Jesus. We may find ourselves struggling, like the psalmist, in the face of evil, of course. However, Psalm 74 is not a psalm, I believe, that Jesus could pray. It has some historical interest, but apart from a few verses, it's hardly suitable for Christian prayer. When it's in blue, it means we're reflecting on it rather than praying it. So I'll read it out for you. O God, my God, why do you leave us abandoned? Why are you so angry against the sheep of your pasture? Remember your assembled people whom you acquired long ago. You freed us that we might be the people who are closest to your heart. Remember Mount Zion, where you established your dwelling. Come and look at where everything lies in ruin. See the devastation the enemy has caused to your sanctuary. Your foes have laid waste the palace, the place of assembly. They've set up their standards there. They've hacked their way in as one takes an axe to the thickest part of the forest. With hatchets and hammers, they've smashed the woodwork. They set your sanctuary on fire. They desecrated your holy dwelling place. As they burnt it to the ground, they cried, "Exterminate the whole nation, burn all the meeting places of God in the land." We have no signs from you. There's no longer a prophet among us. There's no one who knows how long this will last. How long, O God, is the foe to scoff? Is the enemy to revile your name forever? Why are you holding back, keeping your powerful arm hidden from view? Yet you, O God, are our King from of old, bringing salvation to the land. You divided the sea by your might. You broke the heads of the dragons in the sea. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. You gave him as food for the creatures of the wilderness. You opened springs and torrents. You dried up flowing streams. Yours is the day, and yours the night. You established the moon and the sun. You fixed all the bounds of the earth. You made summer and winter. O God, remember this. See how the enemy scoffs and how a foolish people reviles your name. Do not hand over to the wild animals the life and hopes of your dove. Do not forget forever the lives of your poor. Have regard for your covenant. The dark places of the land vomit forth violence. Do not let the downtrodden be defrauded. Let the poor and needy praise your name. Rise up, O God, plead your cause. Remember how the impious scoff at you all day long. Do not forget the clamour of your foes, the uproar of your adversaries that is growing ever more strident. It's a good psalm, and it does express bewilderment and perplexity and begging of God to intervene. Jerusalem, this is the scene behind it, Jerusalem has been devastated. The psalm could be a response to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple by the Babylonians in 587 BC, or, and it may have been updated, by the Syrians in the early 2nd century BC. Judah's enemies mock Jerusalem's God. The psalmist wonders why the Creator God, who conquered chaos, doesn't intervene, but allows the fury of the enemies to prevail. And this, of course, raises a very fundamental question in theology. Does God intervene? Now, to intervene means you're outside and you come in and then you go back again. You intervene. Does God intervene, or is God the constant present? Constant presence, always there, always at the heart of everything, always present, loving. But not intervening from the outside to alter the way things are going. He didn't stop Jesus being crucified, so that's probably the bottom line of all this. And if he didn't stop that dreadful sin, it shouldn't surprise us that God doesn't stop what's happening in Sudan or Syria or whatever. God is loving, inspiring, begging, gracing. And it's up to us to listen, and we can intervene. However, it's a theological point to be deeply pondered, of course. Verse 13 uses the language of myth to speak of God's power in creation. Dragons, talks about, seems to refer to Rahab, the mythological sea serpent. And Leviathan is a monster of chaos in Canaanite mythology. God is portrayed as defeating Rahab and so bringing the ordered creation out of primeval chaos. It's very large, dramatic language. Why does God not come to protect the downtrodden and the poor who cry for help? Good question. It makes no sense that God would allow to be undone what God has done in creating. It makes no sense to the psalmist to reject what God has chosen, us, his chosen people, and in anger God is rejecting us entirely, so it seems. It makes no sense to repudiate what God has redeemed, to choose a dwelling and then let it be burnt, to consecrate it and then let it be profaned. How could the psalmist grapple with that problem? How do we grapple with it? All familiar supports have gone. Where does this leave God's promise? Where does it leave the covenant? What's the meaning of Israel? Will this tragedy ever have an end? The psalmist speaks of Israel as God's dove. It's verse 19. We find the same image in the Song of Songs, where the divine lover says, "O my dove, in the clefts of the rock, in the covert of the cliff, let me see your face. Let me hear your voice, for your voice is sweet and your face beautiful." So I'll leave Psalm 74 there. It's powerful and it's asking radically good questions. I'm not confident they'd be the questions Jesus would be asking, that's all. Praying Psalm 75 now, we can pray with Jesus. So I'll pray it first, comment, and then invite us all to pray it. We give you thanks, O God, and we invoke your name. We proclaim for all to hear your wondrous deeds. I, your God, choose the time to set things right. Even were the earth to totter, I will secure its foundations. I say to the boastful, stop your boasting, and to the wicked, do not flaunt your power. Do not oppose the one on high, or insolently confront your God. For justice is not from east or west or the wilderness or the mountains. It's God who executes judgment. As for me, I will rejoice forever. I will sing praises to the God of Jacob. The strength of the just will be exalted. There are some verses here which they are in the church's prayer, but I'm suggesting we might omit them. And of course, it's only if it's a personal judgment, so you please don't agree with it. But maybe you will agree. These verses that I haven't included in the psalm. God puts one person down and lifts up another. Jesus puts one person down and lifts up another. Does he? Back to the psalm. For in the hand of God is a jug filled with drugged wine. He will pour from it a draught, and the wicked shall drain it to the dregs. God will break the power of the wicked. The psalmist says that God puts one person down and lifts another up. Luke quotes from an early Christian hymn which uses similar language. This is Luke chapter 1. The Lord has shown strength with his arm. He scattered the proud in the thoughts of their hearts. He has brought down the powerful from their thrones and lifted up the lowly. He has filled the hungry with good things and sent the rich away empty. Well, that's a hymn of the New Testament. And Jesus has been seen and watched. So, I'm at a bit of a loss here. Either my understanding of theology is, well, it certainly is this, imperfect, perhaps wrong in places. Or the authors of that hymn that Luke has chosen to quote have not yet fully depthed the understanding of God that Jesus presents. And of course that's true too. So we're dealing with mystery here. We're dealing with something bigger than all our minds and all our theologies can cope with. We just have to do our best to think logically and clearly and humbly. So does God bring down the powerful from their thrones? Well, Hitler stayed there for a long time, and Stalin stayed there for a long time, and we could go on and on and on. Does God send the rich away empty, or does God, in Jesus, plead with the rich young man? He didn't send him away. He pleaded with him. Let that stuff go. Come, join us. And he went away. Sad. Jesus taught us that God is love, and that God's love is poured out over all people, quote, the righteous and the unrighteous alike. So God doesn't change because we change. God doesn't stop loving because we sin. We may not get the love because we've turned our back on it and we reject it, but God doesn't stop doing it. The proud are scattered, yes, but not by God, but as a consequence of their behaviour. Nero was murdered. Roman emperor at the time of the murder of Paul and Peter and many others. Now, he was murdered, not by God, but because he aroused such hatred that they determined to just get rid of him. The proud are scattered, but not by God, but as a consequence of their behaviour. The powerful are brought down, but not by God, but as a consequence of their behaviour. It's not God who sends the rich away empty, as we see in Jesus' response to the rich man who came to him looking for life. If the power of the wicked is broken, as the psalm says, it will be by the power of love. Another verse that's left out, in the hand of God is a jug filled with drugged wine. The image of God holding a jug containing whatever we have to pass through is found in the account of Jesus' agony when Jesus prayed that he would not have to drink from the cup, using the same imagery. Recall also Jesus' words to the sons of Zebedee. Are you able to drink the cup that I am about to drink? And he says to Peter, am I not to drink the cup my Father has given me? Well, that sense of God's presence in our lives and what's happening in our lives is, of course, familiar to Jesus and to Peter and to the writers of the New Testament. It's an image for us having to keep loving, taking the next step of love, whatever might be happening around us, and knowing that God is somehow present in whatever is happening, just as God was present on Calvary, not organizing the crucifixion, of course, but sustaining Jesus in love and trust and forgiveness and goodness. So this image is not meant to reinforce a mistaken image of God controlling everything and putting us through things. And we use it, if we're careless, we use it in our ordinary actions. Say, well, when your time's up, you die. As though God's got some plot ready and organising your time of your death. It might be something to do with a virus. So it's not meant, as I see it, to reinforce a mistaken image of God controlling everything and our future being somehow fixed by God. Rather, it's challenging us, whatever happens, to trust in God's love, which will always be present, to enable us, as it enabled Jesus, to continue to trust and to love in whatever circumstances we find ourselves. That, as I understand it, is what Jesus came to in that struggle, in the agony, in the Gethsemane. He came to that point where he knew what to do. He didn't know what others were going to do, but he knew what he was to do, namely, keep loving, keep embracing the lepers, keep challenging, etc. Keep revealing God as love. So that gave Jesus the strength to carry him through the Passion. A comment on verse 2 and 3. I, your God, choose the time to set things right. Even were the earth to totter, I will secure its foundations. The psalmist, after giving thanks in verse 1, the assembly goes silent and hears God speaking through an oracle. So that's typical of the temple. They're all there, and it would be the high priest, whoever, speaking out of prayer, speaking an oracle, an answer to our prayer to God, waiting, and then God speaks and says, I, your God, choose, etc. The I in verse 2 is emphatic. The psalmist is confident that God will act in God's time. Could we say that we, when we're ready, will respond to God who's acting all the time? Could we say that? That when we're ready, we're the ones that have to be ready, not God. And when we're ready to welcome the grace will be welcomed. It might feel as though the very foundations of the earth are shaken. And the text says, when the foundations are destroyed, what can the righteous do? And again, in another psalm, they have neither knowledge nor understanding. They grope in the dark. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. But we're assured the foundations are secured by God. I will be with you always, to the end of the age. Let's pray Psalm 75 in choir. We give you thanks, O God, as we invoke your name. We proclaim for all to hear your wondrous deeds. I, your God, choose the time to set things right. Even were the earth to totter, I will secure its foundations. I say to the boastful, stop your boasting, and to the wicked, do not flaunt your power. Do not oppose the one on high, or insolently confront your God. For justice is not from east or west, or the wilderness or the mountains. It is God who executes judgment. As for me, I will rejoice forever. I will sing praises to the God of Jacob. The strength of the just will be exalted. And now Psalm 76. Again, I suggest it's for reflection, for pondering. And why not ponder it in Jesus' company? Psalm 76 is not offered for prayer in the lectionary, in the Mass. But it is offered in the prayer of the Church for the prayer during the day on Sundays 2 and 4. When I don't have to tell you this, you know it, but anyhow, I'll say it. The most important hours of the Church's litany of the prayer is, of course, Lords and Vespers, morning and evening. Prayer during the day, of course it's beautiful and of course it has its power, but it is secondary, and sometimes psalms are put there that you don't find in the others. This is an example. Apart from the acknowledgement that God's judgment is to defend the oppressed, the image of God as a warlord who is roused to fury against the enemies of Judah, it's not an image given us by Jesus. Typical of the times, this psalm sees victory or defeat in war as determined by God. It asserts the irresistible power of God against Judah's enemies and celebrates victory in battle, led by the warlord God. Its origin may have been in Judah after the fall of the northern kingdom and the forced withdrawal of Sennacherib and his army from their siege of Jerusalem in 701 BC. It's a likely setting for this psalm, this hymn, which I'll now read for you. God, you're known everywhere in Judah. If my hunch is right, Samaria has fallen. The whole northern kingdom's been wiped out, carried into exile, and other people put in there, which was the Assyrian method of divide and conquer. So that's all happened. But Judah, surely Judah was going to go too, but providentially, there was trouble back over in Assyria, and the army had to withdraw and go back to defend what was happening there, and that meant that Jerusalem wasn't taken. So God, you're known everywhere in Judah. Your fame is great in Israel. Your tent is pitched in Jerusalem, your command post on Mount Zion. There you break the flaming arrows, shield and sword, all weapons of war. You are resplendent, majestic, with mountains of plunder. The stout-hearted are stripped of their spoil. They are dazed, unable to move. At your battle cry, O God of Jacob, both rider and horse lie stunned. You are awesome indeed. Who can stand before you once your anger is aroused? From the heavens you utter judgment. The earth reels and is hushed in silence when you rise up as judge to defend the oppressed. When you're robed in fury, even warriors must praise you. Make your vows to God, to Yahweh, your God, Elohim. Carry out what you've promised. Bring your gifts to the one who is awesome, who cuts off the breath of princes and inspires fear in the kings of the earth. And now we pray Psalm 77 with Jesus. The psalmist is desperate. He lies awake at night, worrying about his situation, which is such that he wonders whether God no longer cares for him. God seems absent, but the psalmist cries out, trusting that he'll be heard. He doesn't stop seeking this apparently absent God. He cannot see, nor can he touch, but he keeps stretching out, hoping for contact. We all know this kind of prayer. It's God who keeps the heart of the psalmist alert and his eyes open, longing to see. Even though he cannot find words and his experience of God is tenuous and uncertain, the psalmist struggles to make sense of what is happening. The psalmist's problem is that God seems to be acting contrary to how God has revealed God's self to be. After all, God did proclaim to Moses, Yahweh, Yahweh, a God of merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in covenant love and faithfulness. That's Exodus. The psalmist is asking, where is this covenant love? Where is this graciousness? Where is this tender compassion now? And as he asks those questions, there's only silence. I'll pray it for you and then we'll comment on it. I cry aloud to God, cry aloud that God might hear me. In my anguish I search for you, my God. My hands are raised at night without ceasing. My soul refuses to be comforted. I remember God and I moan. I reflect and my spirit faints. You withhold sleep from my eyes. I'm troubled and I cannot speak. I consider the days of old, remembering years long gone. All night memories fill my heart. I ponder and my spirit keeps on questioning. Perhaps God will always reject me and will never again turn and grace me. Perhaps God's covenant love to me is exhausted. God's promises have come to an end. Has God forgotten to be gracious? Can anger block God's mercy? I find myself saying, woe is me, the power of the Most High has altered. I remember your deeds, O God, yes, I recall your wonders of old. I reflect on all that you've done and muse on your mighty deeds. Your way, my God, is holy. What God is great like you? You are God who works wonders. You display your might among the peoples. With your strong arm you redeem your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. The psalmist tries to sustain his spirit by recalling the wonderful ways in which God showed his care at the time of the Exodus from Egypt. And he goes on, seeing you, it's the Red Sea, the waters churned, shuddering, writhing, convulsed to the depths. Clouds poured down rain, thunder shook the heavens, lightning darted like arrows. Your thunder rolled round the sky. Your lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way led through the sea. Your path through the mighty waters. Yet no one saw your footprints. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. Your way led through the sea, the Red Sea. Your path through the mighty waters. Yet no one saw your footprints. That's verse 19, and it calls to mind a gospel scene which is drawing on that psalm, the imagery of it. Because that's what the New Testament does all the time. It's their only language, is the language of the Bible. So the imagery keeps coming back in, and that's how they try to share their experience of Jesus in these dramatic words from their tradition. So This scene of gospel of Jesus, you know it, walking on the sea. Your way led through the sea, your path through the mighty waters, yet no one saw your footprints. And the text in Mark says, when evening came, the boat was out on the sea and Jesus was alone on the land. When he saw that they were straining at the oars against an adverse wind, he came towards them early in the morning, walking on the sea. He intended to pass them by, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost, and they cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, take heart, pardon the Greek, ego eimi, that's the word, that's Yahweh, that's it's the sacred name, ego eimi, I am. Do not be afraid. Then, says Mark, Jesus got into the boat and the wind dropped. When we read this verse 19 of the Psalm, we might think too of Jesus passing through death to the risen life and opening the way for us through death to follow. The psalmist is experiencing a profound, even desperate longing for communion with God. God who seems to be absent. Verse 7, perhaps God will never again turn to me and be gracious to me. When we reflect on the transcendence of God and the necessarily mysterious dimension of God's presence and action in our lives, it shouldn't surprise us that this experience of God as absent is a significant element in everyone's religious experience. Just think of someone really dear to you who's absent. And you feel the absence. Of course, well, they're very present to you if you're feeling their absence so much. You just haven't forgotten them, they've just gone. But you, a feeling of absence is very deep feeling of presence, paradoxically. In the Hebrew scriptures, it's expressed beautifully in the Song of Songs, which I'll spend a little time with you on now. Bernard of Clairvaux, in his Sermon 79 on the Song of Songs, he's written this four books of it. I used to have them, but as sometimes happened, I gave them to someone I can't remember who I gave them to, so I haven't got them now. But anyhow, I hope they're reading them. Bernard of Clairvaux writes, who is it whom your soul loves? For whom do you inquire? Has he no name? Who are you? Who is he? In this marriage song, Song of Songs, it is affections, not words, that are to be considered. Why is this, except that the holy love, which is the subject of the entire song, cannot be expressed by words, but only indeed and in truth. Here love speaks everywhere. If you desire to grasp these writings, Song of Songs, you must love. For anyone who doesn't love, it's useless to listen to this song of love, for a cold heart cannot catch fire from its eloquence. The Song of Songs makes a unique contribution to the Hebrew Bible in that it's a celebration of sexual love. The reader is left in no doubt that the yearning, the joy of discovery, the delight of consummation are part and a significant part of the creation which God looks upon and sees to be, in the words of Genesis, very good. We're reminded of the statement in the book of Genesis that it is as male and female that human beings are created, quote, in the image of God. And we hear the delight in Adam's voice when, and these are the first words spoken by a human being in the Bible, when God gives him Eve as his companion. The Hebrew is, because God's been looking at all the other animals, and he's been naming them, but he's not happy with any of them. And then God offers him Eve, and then his words, you'll have to smile at this because they're quite powerful in Hebrew. He says, Zut, Zut, like, God, help us, now you're talking. And he welcomes Eve. And all that's put beautifully in the painting on the roof of the Sistine Chapel, where God, the Creator, and God's got his arm around Eve, and Adam's reaching out. And so it's as man and woman that we are created in God's image. Though this delight in the erotic dimension of human sexual love is apparent in the text, commentators over the centuries, both Jewish and Christian, have passed quickly, and I'm suggesting perhaps too quickly, to see in the song a mystical account of the love between God and the chosen people, between Christ and the church. And that's beautiful, of course, taking nothing from that. But I think we can't lose the perspective that the song is actually about male-female love. The New Testament is full of statements of God's love. In relation to the theme of the Song of Songs, we think of Jesus speaking of himself as the bridegroom. We think too of Paul's reflections in Ephesus chapter 5 and the nuptial banquet described in the concluding chapters of the book of Revelation. It was Origen's masterly 10-volume commentary on the Song of Songs, sadly only parts of it are extant, composed between 240 and 245 AD, that set the pattern for subsequent Christian reflection, which focused on Christ's love for the church and also on the mystical love encounter with God that God offers to each and every person. The long tradition of interpretation calls us to see in human love a sacrament of God's love for us personally and for us as a community. The Song of Songs helps us avoid the danger of treating God's love for us and our response of love in too abstract a way. We're helped to reflect on God's yearning to love and our profound need for divine communion. And we recall the famous words of St. Augustine, "You've made us for yourself, O God, and our heart is restless till we rest in you." Our heart is rested, so is our body restless. Everything about us is restless till we rest in him. Like the psalmist, the lover is searching for the beloved who appears to be absent. I'm quoting now from the Psalm, chapter 3. "Upon my bed at night I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I didn't find him. I called him, but he gave no answer. I will rise and seek him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I didn't find him." And verse 5 of chapter 5 of the song, "I opened to my lover, but my lover had turned away, gone. My soul fainted within me. I sought him, but I didn't find him. I called him, but he gave no answer." We find the same theme in the spiritual canticle of John of the Cross. "Where have you hidden, beloved, and left me moaning. You fled like the stag after wounding me. I went out calling you, and you were gone. Seeking my love, John continues, I will go off to the mountains and to the waterside. Who has the power to heal me? How do you endure, O life, not living where you live, and being brought near death by the arrows you receive from that which you conceive of your beloved? Why, since you wounded this heart, why do you not heal it? And why, since you stole it from me, do you leave it so and fail to carry off what you've stolen? You've stolen my heart and it's just lying there. May my eyes behold you, because you are their light, and I would open them to you alone. Reveal your presence. May the vision of your beauty be my death. For the sickness of love is not cured except by your presence and your image. O crystal spring, writes John, if only on your silvered over face you would suddenly form the eyes I desire. And for John, the eyes he desires, the face of God, are the eyes of Jesus. He wants to be seen. If only on your silvered over face you'd suddenly form the eyes I desire, which I bear sketched deep within my heart. We will go on to the high caverns in the rock, which are so well concealed. There you will show me what my soul has been seeking. And then you will give me yourself. In his commentary on the poem, John of the Cross states, so he wrote the poem and then I asked him to explain it to them. Well, he can't explain a poem except by repeating it, but he tried. And so this is what he has to say. The sublime communication and the feeling of God being near is not a sign of the presence and grace of God. Nor is dryness and the lack of feeling of God's closeness a sign of God's absence. Feelings are feelings. They're important, but they're not a sign. And he continues his commentary. What more do you want? What else do you search for outside when within yourself you possess your riches, delights, satisfactions, fullness and kingdom? Your beloved, whom you desire and seek, is already there. Be joyful and gladdened in your interior recollection with him, for you have him so close to you. Desire him there. Adore him there. Do not go in pursuit of him outside yourself. You'll only become distracted and weary, and you'll not find him or enjoy him more securely or sooner or more intimately than by seeking him within you. There's but one difficulty, even though he does abide within you. He's hidden. Nevertheless, it's vital for you to know the place of his hiding, that you may search for him there with assuredness. And this is also what you seek when, with the affection of love, you question, where have you hidden, beloved? It brings special happiness to a person to understand, writes John, that God is never absent, not even from a person in mortal sin. What a powerful statement that is. Have we always taught that? Were you taught that? Mortal sin is killing the soul. There's no doubt about that. But God is present. God hasn't gone. God is present. In fact, God's presence is the only possibility of repentance and healing. John continues, since you know that the beloved whom you desire lives hidden within your heart, strive to be yourself truly hidden there with him, and you will embrace him within and experience him with loving affection. This is what it means, says John, to seek him in faith. However confident you may be that you find, experience, and understand God, you must, because God is inaccessible and concealed, always regard God as hidden and serve him who is hidden in a secret way. Do not be like those foolish people whose understanding of God is so poor that they think that God is absent just because they don't understand, taste, or experience him. We don't go to prayer to experience God. We go to prayer for God. We don't go to experience being loving. We go to experience love. And John again, you suffer so intently for God this time because you're drawing nearer to God. And so you have greater experience within yourself of the void of God, of very heavy darkness and of spiritual fire which dries up and purges you so that thus purified you may be united with God. So let's pray Psalm 77 with perhaps some of those reflections in our prayer. I cry aloud to God, cry aloud that God might hear me. In my anguish I search for you, my God. My hands are raised at night without ceasing. My soul refuses to be comforted. I remember God and I moan. I reflect and my spirit faints. You withheld sleep from my eyes. I'm troubled and cannot speak. I consider the days of old, remembering years long gone. All night memories fill my heart. I ponder and my spirit keeps on questioning. Perhaps God will always reject me and will never again turn and grace me. Perhaps God's covenant love to me is exhausted. God's promises have come to an end. Has God forgotten to be gracious? Can anger block God's mercy? I find myself saying, woe is me. The power of the Most High has altered. I remember your deeds, O God. Yes, I recall your wonders of old. I reflect on all that you have done and muse on your mighty deeds. Your way, my God, is holy. What God is great like you? You are God who works wonders. You display your might among the peoples. With your strong arm, you redeem your people, the descendants of Jacob and Joseph. Seeing you, the waters churned, shuddering, writhing, convulsed to the depths. Clouds poured down rain, thunder shook the heavens, lightning darted like arrows. Your thunder rolled around the sky, your lightning lit up the world, the earth trembled and shook. Your way led through the sea, your path through the mighty waters. Yet no one saw your footprints. You led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron.